Welcome to this week's edition of the Talking Newspaper for St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding area. I'm Bill Redway and this is the Red Saturn programme for the week ending Saturday the 15th of November 2019. Now last month I played an old folk song about the Franklin Expedition of 1848, which was lost without trace in the northern reaches of Canada. This time I'm playing a medley of Irish tunes, but by a Canadian group known as Searson, which is essentially two sisters, Erin and Colleen Searson, from the Ottawa Valley in Ontario. We're very grateful that they've generously allowed us to use their music on Talking Newspapers. The track is called Bright Nights, and I'll play it in full at the end of the programme. This week, of course, we have the latest news stories from the current edition of the Hearts Advertiser, followed by suggested listings of programmes on national radio that might be of interest to you over the next 7 days, courtesy of Sue once again. In part two, Deborah Heath and Rob Pearman discuss The Midwich Cuckoos by John Wyndham. And in part three, we have an interesting story from Hertfordshire Life magazine, beautifully read by Lucy, about the Knights Templar and their considerable influence in Hertfordshire in the 12th and 13th centuries. We start with the news, and our readers today are Margaret, Elizabeth, Dominic and Sarah.
Hello, my name's Margaret and my first piece today is about a daughter's plea to tackle a danger road. The daughter of a woman who died in a crash on Redbourne Road is calling for vital safety improvements to prevent further fatalities. Whitney Elizabeth Hughes, aged 28, of Warley Road, St Albans, is desperate to stop anyone else from being killed on the route. Whitney's mother Gillian Williams and motorist Tony Southwood both died after being involved in a collision on the Redbourne Road on Wednesday, October the 9th. Whitney Elizabeth said, "My mum was only 55 when she died. She was on her way back from work. She was a hard-working woman and had just moved back to work in her hometown of St Albans and was so excited about being back. My mum told me several times that Redbourne Road is dangerous and to be careful as people have died in accidents there. I'm devastated that my mum has had her life taken away from her at such a young age. I really hope that something can be done to prevent more deaths on this road." Whitney believes the road would be much safer with speed cameras and better lighting. Figures that she obtained from Hearts County Council confirm that another fatal accident occurred at 6:29pm on December the 15th, 2016, with a man in his 40s declared dead at the junction with Verulam Road and Hempstead Road. Another person died, and three were seriously injured, in a collision on Redbourne Road on May the 12th, 2018. And the statistics show that a total of 18 people have died on that road since 1980. In 2014, after the death of a cyclist on the same road, then Councillor Maxine Crawley donated the monies from her locality's budget for safety improvements. She said at the time that her actions were prompted by a petition from residents calling for a footpath wide enough for both cyclists and pedestrians on the Redbourne Road. Speaking to the Hearts Advertiser this week, she said, "What we did was got a working party together and highways officers and residents and I met and came up with ideas to make the road safer. The medium-term plan was to sort out the footpath and improve the drainage so that the road wouldn't be so wet from flooding, which we did. But by the time you manage to get the foliage under control, it needs doing again. The long-term plan was to really improve the road, which needed a lot of money, which we were trying to source. That was when I stopped being a county councillor. Chairman of Redbourne Parish Council, Councillor David Mitchell, said Redbourne Parish Council has a meeting scheduled with Hearts Highways on December the 16th to discuss this road. I've already spoken to County Councillor Annie Brewster about the deaths in recent years. I think that one of the problems is that the road is very straight and wide, being once three lanes. Whilst the cause of the recent accident is unknown to me and speeding seems unlikely, I know people do tend to drive fast down this road. In an ideal world, we would like the width of the road reduced and a dedicated cycle path and separate pavement. Hopefully that would make sure pedestrians and cyclists were safe. Of course, we know this would be very expensive. A spokesperson for Hertfordshire Highways said, "We were obviously saddened to hear of the recent fatalities on the A5183 Redbourne Road and are continuing to work closely with the police on the ongoing investigation. The safety of all road users and pedestrians is of paramount importance to Hertfordshire County Council, and we always encourage residents to voice any concerns which they might have about their local roads."
Hello, my name is Elizabeth, and my piece is "Calls to Secure Country Park Before Quarry Decision Sparks Community Protest." Smallford residents are hoping that Ellenbrook Fields becomes a country park before any quarry development is considered. The site, situated in the Coney Heath Parish near Knockcut's Nursery in Smallford, is being considered as a proposed quarry by Hertfordshire County Council. Smallford's Residents Association, Ellenbrook Area Residents Association, the Wellin Hatfield Labour Party and Liberal Democrat groups for St Albans and Wellin Hatfield all hope the promise of a country park will go ahead. To make their point, protesters gathered at Ellenbrook's Fields Park Run on Saturday morning with placards which read, "Save our park, stop the quarry." The developer, Arlington, had agreed Ellenbrook would be a green space under a Section 106 agreement. It's a potential loss of access to a much-loved park used by local residents and over 300 park runners every week, said Rosie Newbigging, Labour's parliamentary candidate for Wellin Hatfield. She said one protester told her, "Once the quarrying starts, that's it, the park is gone." Ms Newbigging added, "This is a potential environmental disaster on the doorstep of residents. The proposed quarrying presents a number of very real threats to the health and well-being of local residents." Hugh Burrell from Smallford Residents Association has previously cited the Hertfordshire County Council application's environmental baseline report and a bromate plan and data set that he thinks reveals the presence of the carcinogenic compound bromate. He said if it is disturbed, it could have serious implications for drinking water, as it would reduce supply in the event of an accident. St Albans City and District Council's Planning Referrals Committee met last week and raised concerns about the plans, agreeing to submit formal representations as part of its response to the County Council. Speaking at the meeting, Mr Burrell urged district councillors, "Remember Camelford, a Cornish town where there is a large quarry, and the repercussions there, and I would put to you we have an even greater threat and level of contamination here on the old aerodrome." The Conservatives' parliamentary candidate for St Albans, Anne Main, has already asked Prime Minister Boris Johnson to look into the proposals. Speaking before Parliament was dissolved, she said, "There are plans to drill a new gravel quarry in Smallford, which may disturb the plume and cause it to enter the watercourses. Will the Prime Minister use his good offices to ensure that the Environment Agency does not allow quarrying on this gravel pit until the toxicity of the bromate plume has been fully assessed?" Mr Johnson responded he would get on to the Environment Secretary immediately and ensure that it's taken up. Affinity Water and the Environment Agency say they are monitoring the situation and have no concerns about the bromate plume at present. An Environment Agency spokesman said, Over the past 7 years, we have had regular discussions with Affinity Water and the Brett Aggregates re the shape and control of the proposed development at Hatfield Aerodrome. He also pointed out that in 2017, it did issue an environmental permit for the backfill and restoration to create the country park. Brett Aggregates, which hopes to build the quarry, told this newspaper that the site was identified in the county's own minerals local plan for a number of years. It also stressed that this location is the subject of a planning application currently being decided by Herts County Council. A spokesperson said, "It is supported by a full environmental assessment, and as part of this process, we have provided the authorities with the latest environmental studies, including assessments on groundwater quality." Arlington said it is not stepping away from the development of the Ellenbrook Park Preservation Trust. A spokesman said, "It was intended that the establishment of the Ellenbrook Park Preservation Trust takes place once the landscape management document works were completed, in order that the land was then leased to the trust and Arlington pay a commuted sum for its ongoing management and maintenance. To be clear, Arlington does not step away from the trust, but remains an integral part of the ongoing relationship to the land, with 5 of the 11 trustees being representatives from Arlington. In the meanwhile, the public continue to have access and Arlington continue to maintain the land at our cost. Wellin Hatfield Borough Council's Development Management Committee will meet this Thursday at 7 in the evening in Welwyn Garden City to discuss the quarry."
Hello, my name is Dominic and the headline for my first story is Station Bridge Community Mural is Painted Over. A former St Albans mayor was horrified to discover a community mural she commissioned during her tenure has been destroyed. Councillor Annie Brewster's final mayoral project in 2014 was to oversee the creation of artwork celebrating the history of St Albans for wooden panels on the north side of Victoria Street Bridge near the city station. At the time, Councillor Brewster described the project as an attempt to transform a previously blank bridge saying very little about St Albans into an emblem of all that is great about our city. Devised in collaboration with Larry Heyman of First Capital Connect, Lynn Howarth of Bridge Owners National Rail and graffiti art company On The Level Productions, the mural chronologically depicted key moments in the city's history, including the building of the Roman Theatre of Verulamium, St Alban and the Alban Bun. But this week, she was shocked to discover the mural had been painted over without warning or consultation. Councillor Brewster said, "I am dismayed that the panels have been removed and destroyed. It was my final mayoral project in 2014, and it was immensely challenging to deliver, requiring approval from an endless list of stakeholders. The Wedgwood blue paint colour on the bridge was inspired by the walls of the mayor's parlour, and the panels were designed to celebrate our unrivalled timeline of people, places and events, incredibly important as we do not have many actual artefacts to exhibit that are relevant to these amazing stories." Our main railway station welcomes tourists from all over the world, so the Victoria Street Bridge was an ideal gateway to showcase our 2,000 years of remarkable history. The opening ceremony attracted a relevant representative for each panel, including Christiane Kubrick, who unveiled the Space Odyssey artwork dedicated to her husband, Stanley. It is unbelievable that the panels were not once defaced in 5 years. As they were the original artwork commissioned by a professional artist, the corners had started to wear. However, they were not beyond repair, and we plan to take high-resolution photographs of them to then be touched up digitally and finally reproduced on metal, a much longer-lasting material. Councillor Brewster continued, "The plan was to replace the butterfly word panel and create a new one for the Duchess of Marlborough. Our 1553 Royal Charter Market, the railway signal box and our new museum and gallery. I do not know when the changes in direction happened and was not party to the decision." Portfolio holder for Business, Culture and Tourism, Councillor Mandy McNeil, explained that the mural had been painted over because exposure to the weather had resulted in it becoming chipped and worn, but the panels could not be repaired. Councillor McNeill said. Several years ago, Councillor Annie Brewster paved the way for art in public spaces. Sadly, the project, which Councillor Brewster championed, was severely damaged over time by the elements and was removed in early September. I look forward to working with Councillor Brewster and the St Albans Museum and Gallery to see how the photographs from the original project may be able to be preserved and displayed so that the legacy remains. I'm also excited to be working with the bridge owner, Network Rail, and with Govia on a new concept being a public art gallery. We are working with the Civic Society on the first exhibition and with professional photographer Steve Else, who is generously giving his time to help showcase the amazing Conservation 50 Schools and Art Design project. I look forward to the launch of this exhibition and other community-focused arts initiatives as we celebrate the Heart's Year of Culture 2020. Thank you to all of our district businesses and residents who assist with funding, resourcing, volunteer hours for championing local art projects and helping to make our city more vibrant.
Hello, I'm Sarah. A controversial start for me. Did BIM exploit school visit for blatant electioneering? Harpenden's Conservative parliamentary candidate has been condemned for tarnishing a school visit with political electioneering. Former MP Bim Afolami, who will be standing again in December's general election, visited St George's School in the town as part of their Eco Week event. But he subsequently tweeted, "We spoke about hashtag climate change, and they quizzed me about the positive changes a Conservative government would continue to make if re-elected. Hashtag general election 2019, hashtag vote Conservative 2019. Local resident Carol Hedges, who's previously worked at the school and whose grown-up daughter was once a pupil there, said she believed St George's has inadvertently allowed pupils to be used as political propaganda. The hashtags used by Afolami here are quite blatant electioneering. Had my daughter still been at the school, this is something I would have been prepared to take up with the governors. It's not right for pupils who are not able to vote in an election to be used as material to further Mr. Afolami's career or to suggest that they agree with the views held by the Conservatives. I'm sure many parents who do not and would not vote Conservative and are, like me, pretty appalled at the attitude of climate change expressed by them would not be happy about the way he has, in my opinion, used the privilege of visiting the school to advertise his own political party and the upcoming election." Carol's comments were echoed by other people on Twitter. Bernard for Britain posted, "I find it disgusting that you've abused your position to campaign for election using one of our local schools. I will be writing to the head of the school to protest. I hope many parents will do too." Peter Neal fumed, "A hat trick. One, suck up to Johnson, supporting Brexit even though your constituents don't. Two, get a bag carrier job at Transport so you can go AWOL rather than support Harpenden commuters. Three, exploit schoolchildren during an election campaign." Napoleon Solo added, "I cannot describe how strongly I object to our schoolchildren being used as agents in a Tory election campaign, quite apart from the suboptimal commitment to climate change by your party, to hashtag vote Conservative feels exploitative." Bim Afolami responded to the accusations. "I was pleased to be invited to St George's School to talk about climate change for their Eco Week. Whilst I was there, I learned that they're holding their own general election at the school and I wanted to show my support for their Conservative candidates." The Hearts advertiser contacted St George's School, but they declined to comment on the matter.
My next piece is headed, "A Christmas Festival event promises a cracking start to kick off the season." Over 12,000 people are expected at a street party that will kick-start the festive season in St Albans. The St Albans Christmas Cracker Street Festival will take place in the city centre from noon on Sunday, November the 17th. Among the attractions, there will be live music, a Santa's grotto, a children's craft tent, market stalls, funfair rides, a giant snow globe, a winter wonderland bar and street performers. The event, organised by St Albans District Council, will culminate with the switching on of the lights at dusk, hosted by Mayor of St Albans, Councillor Janet Smith, at the Clock Tower. There will also be a countdown at the stage opposite the beach house before a pyrotechnics display and the switching on of the St. Peter's Street column lights. Musical acts will perform on the taxi rank stage, and street performers and musical entertainment will take place near the clock tower. Councillor Mandy McNeill, portfolio holder for Business, Culture and Tourism, said the St. Albans Christmas Cracker Street Festival will be a terrific way for people to get the festive season underway. The main objective this year is to celebrate our many local charities, not-for-profits and community groups that work hard to make a difference in our district. We hope to raise awareness and funds for them. The festive programme has been developed with many organisations, including city centre and district businesses, pubs, local media partners and a host of community groups, which have been working with the council to create a fabulous series of events to bring the community together this Christmas. The Christmas Cracker will be one of the major highlights of our programme. We're doing things a little differently this year, with some special features to make it even more interactive and Christmassy. I urge everyone to go along so they do not miss out on all the fun for children and the whole family. The event will also boost the local economy by bringing in thousands of extra visitors, as well as showcasing our fantastic city centre and the local artisan produce on sale at the market stalls. And you can get more information and the full programme at the website www.enjoystalbans.com.
A question. Can you help local families hoping to spend their final Christmas at home together? Rennygrove Hospice Care is planning ahead so that it can give as many patients as possible a family Christmas at home together. The charity, whose nurses provide specialist care and support for adults and children with a life-limiting illness, is asking its supporters if they can make a donation towards the costs of its nursing care over Christmas. Helen is a hospice at home nurse, she said. What I love about Rennygrove is that we can be there any time of the day or night, 365 days a year, and our 24-hour responsive care is never more important than at Christmas, when so many other healthcare providers offer a reduced service. Mandy Bass's family, husband Kevin, daughter Laura and son James, know firsthand how Rennygrove's nurses can help families spend a last Christmas together. James explains, Mum had a relatively short illness, which started out with lung cancer and spread to her liver, skin and ultimately her brain. She fought it with all she could, and sometimes you wouldn't even realise she was ill. Her main aim was to get to Christmas with all her family around her. The Rennygrove nurses made that possible. Without their constant support, practical advice and compassionate care, we wouldn't have had the same quality time together as a family. We can't thank Rennygrove enough for enabling us to make happy memories in those final days of Mum's life. Thanks to them, Mum lived the life she wanted to until the very end and passed away peacefully in her home with her family around her. Christmas is going to be hard this year, but those memories will help us to get through it. And there's a lovely photograph of her with her husband and son and daughter, obviously taken last Christmas. Without your help, Rennygrove could not provide its specialist care in patients' homes at any time of the day or night. Please, can you spare whatever you can afford to make a difference to families preparing for their last Christmas together? £25 will pay for 1 hour of nursing care for a patient like Mandy. Rennygrove needs to find £21,000 every day to help all those who need them, and your help towards this will make a real difference. You can donate securely by calling 01442 890 222.
Extinction Rebellion urges Barclays Bank to clean up its act on climate. Members of Extinction Rebellion gathered outside Barclays Bank in St. Albans as part of a campaign to discourage financial institutions from funding the climate emergency. The group of 20 protesters, dressed in pinafores and waved feathered dusters outside the bank on Saturday, were trying to suggest that the bank should clean up its act when it comes to the climate crisis. According to the group, 33 banks have lent $1.9 trillion to the fossil fuel industry since 2016. When fossil fuels are used, they produce carbon, which is leading to global heating, a rise in sea levels, and the extinction of thousands of species. Extinction Rebellion specifically pointed to Barclays' funding of Arctic oil exploration and the extraction of fossil fuel from tar sands, which causes huge damage to the climate. Harpenden resident Sarah Brenman, who attended the protest, said, "We have to stop banks financing the climate emergency, and Barclays are the worst in Europe." Bethany Mogi, who lives in St Albans, added, "I'm protesting here because for Barclays to be funding Arctic oil exploration is unforgivable." The protest in St Albans was one of more than 20 outside Barclays banks across the UK, which all took place at midday on Saturday. Extinction Rebellion want to remind banks and their customers that the investments they make are some of the most powerful forces in existence for financing the continued use of fossil fuels, and urges them to invest in renewable energy such as wind and wave power instead. Dr. Mangala Patelmead from St Albans said, "The time has come to change. As one of the biggest retail banks, Barclays has a lot of clout and should be making the right choices." In an energy and climate change statement published in January this year, Barclays cited the important role that banks have to play in helping to limit the threat that climate change poses to people and to the natural environment, while still supporting economic growth. A Barclays spokesperson said, "We facilitated $27.3 billion in social and environmental financing last year, and we are determined to do all we can to support the transition to a low-carbon economy, while also ensuring that global energy needs continue to be met."
Remembrance. Remembrance parades and services have been held in St Albans and Harpenden to remember those who lost their life or were seriously injured while serving in the armed forces. In St Albans, a Remembrance Sunday parade started in St Peter's Street and proceeded to the War Memorial near St Peter's Church for a service led by Reverend Canon Mark Dearnley. Representatives from Air, Sea and Army cadets, the guiding and scout movements, and the police and ambulance and fire services all took part. Among them were honorary aldermen, district and town parish councillors, the leaders from different religions. Mayor of St Albans, Councillor Janet Smith, also attended, dressed in her official robes and accompanied by her mace bearer, and laid a wreath along with the Lord Lieutenant of Hertfordshire, Robert Voss. At 11 a.m, Councillor Smith returned to the War Memorial to mark the 2 minute silence and emphasise the importance of paying respect to the fallen and injured, while also thinking of those who are currently serving around the world. She said, "These acts of remembrance are so important. Remembering those who gave their lives for freedom inspires us to value one another." The Harpenden Remembrance Sunday Parade met in Leighton Road and then headed to the War Memorial for a service of remembrance shortly before 11 a.m. After the service, the parade reformed for an address from Harpenden's Mayor, Councillor Brian Ellis. Another parade took place at Christchurch in Radlett, with a service of remembrance held at the War Memorial. Pupils from Haberdashers Ask School for Girls joined up with neighbouring junior school students from Haberdashers Ask School for Boys to lay wreaths honouring those who gave their lives in service for their country. Remembrance services were also being held across the district to mark Remembrance Day on Monday, November the 11th, the actual anniversary of the armistice. This article is accompanied by several colourful photos which highlight the variety of community groups, young and old, commemorating this event.
This next piece is about a Redbourne actor who has written a film about suicide in men and is hoping to raise enough money to get it into production. Kieran Seabrook France has penned Forever and Always about a father's last day on earth before he takes his own life. The film was inspired by the loss of a close friend to mental illness and requires £2,000 to go ahead. The 24-year-old said he's hoping to enter the film into international film festivals in order to help people better understand the complexities of male suicide. Once the funds are raised, filming will take place at Kieran's house in Redbourne and in the Hub coffee shop in the High Street, using trained actors. There will be four adult actors and 1 2-year-old cast in the screenplay. He is keen to challenge some stereotypes and myths about suicide, such as if people talk about suicide, they are attention-seeking and not seriously considering it. Kieran said, "Ask around. Most of the older generation will think it's younger people who take their own lives. The statistics show us a different story. In the UK, the highest suicide rate is amongst men aged 45 to 49. Not all the money I'm raising is going into the film. For every £10 pledged, we will donate £1 to the charity Mind in support of mental health. Forever and Always has the power to help highlight the perceived barriers with regard to reaching out about mental health and the impact it can have on the world. With people helping, we can break down these barriers and save lives from a preventable death. My film has the ability to change lives, short and simple." According to Samaritans, men in the UK are 3 times more likely to die by suicide than women. In the Republic of Ireland, the rate is 4 times higher among men than women. Kieran has just returned from a national tour of The Secret Garden and Treasure Island, where he performed at Hatfield House in the summer. In the UK, there were 6,507 suicides last year. Death by suicide rose by 11.8% in the UK in 2018.
There's a lovely photograph of children playing street cricket to head this article. Playing out scheme to get children having fun outdoors. A scheme has been launched to encourage children in St Albans District to play safely outside in their neighbourhood. Playing Out St Albans is part of a nationwide campaign to let young people take over traffic-free streets for a few hours. They can then cycle, scoot, enjoy games and experience how life was for previous generations. The scheme was established by the environment charity Sustainable St Albans and is supported by St Albans City and District Council. Applications for street closures for 2020 have opened, allowing residents to team up and submit requests for appropriate dates and times. The launch of next year's programme follows a highly successful pilot project last summer when 11 streets trialled the concept. Councillor Anthony Rowlands, portfolio holder for Community Leisure and Sport, said, "This is an outstanding initiative that has a wide range of fantastic community benefits. It gets people out and about, meeting their neighbours and enjoying themselves. I encourage parents who think their children will enjoy the experience to consider making an application for their street." Leslie Flowers, a trustee of Sustainable St Albans, said, "Playing out is a simple idea and a fabulous way of strengthening our communities. It encourages health, happiness and a sense of belonging. It's an inspiring grassroots movement that makes streets more child-friendly, and it's great that St Albans is joining in." To take advantage of the three scheme, residents must organise a street meeting, enlist neighbours to volunteer as stewards, and submit an application. Coordinators can then loan a kit bag containing road closure signs and high-vis jackets. Allowances will be made for residents who need to access their vehicle in a closed area. A steward will accompany them to their car and ensure children are out of harm's way before they drive off. An information session will take place at Beach House, St Peter's Street, St Albans, on Friday, November the 15th at 10:30 a.m.
St Albans Community Centre will be able to expand its services after being awarded £73,500 for major improvements. St Albans District Council is giving the money to the Jubilee Centre in Catherine Street, which runs a wide range of activities for local people of all ages. The money will allow the centre to host more activities and help boost people's physical and mental well-being. The fund has been allocated from Section 106 payments, or money contributed by property developers for community infrastructure, in recognition of the impact of new housing or other buildings. Friends of the Jubilee Centre were also involved in the application to the council. The money will go to Hertfordshire Independent Living Service, which is a charitable social enterprise that owns the building's leasehold and provides services for older and vulnerable people. A new community group has been formed to tackle the growing problem of plastic littering in Harpenden. Plastic Free Harpenden was set up on Facebook following concerns by local residents about the amount of litter in the town and the feeling that members of the community wanted to do something to increase awareness of littering. The group has organised its first event for November the 17th, with an hour of litter picking taking place around the town. Founder Natalie Edwards said, "This is just the beginning of a long journey to reduce our reliance on plastic." Plastic Free Harpenden is a way of getting people to focus on this issue and to get them involved in initiatives to achieve this goal. The event will start outside the public halls at 2 p.m. and will end with a hot beverage served at the George Pub. The group said it's a great way to exercise and make new friends and enjoy the fresh air while doing their best for the environment. And you can find more information on the Facebook page Plastic Free Harpenden. Rough sleepers will be offered more beds at a homeless shelter during the winter months in St Albans. In previous years, extra beds were only used when it snowed or the temperature dropped below a certain level. But as part of the council's severe weather emergency provision, five additional beds funded by St Albans District Council are available to Open Door, Brickett Road, every night until the end of March. Local churches are planning to provide further beds in case Open Door reaches its capacity. Rough sleepers who use the severe weather emergency provision will also be given advice on the support services also available to them. Other recent initiatives aim to support rough sleepers, including Housing First, which is a programme run by Hightown on behalf of St Albans District Council and Decorum, which plans to assist 8 to 12 rough sleepers and give them a fresh start, including a place of their own.
Election hustings. A general election hustings will be held at St Albans Cathedral this month to give members of the public a chance to question candidates. The hustings will be held at 7:30 p.m. on Monday, November the 25th, ahead of the general election on Thursday, December the 12th. Parliamentary candidates competing to be MP for St Albans, who have been announced so far, are Daisy Cooper for the Liberal Democrats, Rebecca Lurie for Labour, and Anne Main for the Conservatives, and all will be there to answer questions from the public. The hustings will be held in the nave, which can accommodate around 520 people in the centre section, with space for more at the sides, but with a restricted view. The chair of the event has yet to be confirmed. Everyone is welcome, and questions must be submitted in advance up until 5 p.m. on Thursday, November the 21st. Send your questions to hustings@stalbanscathedral.org. Wellbeing Day. A St Albans school has dedicated a whole day to the well-being of students. St Albans Girls' School hosted their first Student Wellbeing Day last month. Pupils were off timetable and engaged in sessions based on resilience and positivity while learning about support and strategies available. Girls took part in activities such as chocolate making, an inflatable army assault course, gardening, bread making, yoga, mindfulness, dance, netball, football, nail painting, music, outdoor games, computing, weaving, cross stitch, and bathing the school guinea pigs. Deputy head teacher Karen Thomas said, "There's never been a more important time to think about young people's well-being. No matter how much we tell them that being themselves is enough, the pressures to adhere to societal goals is acute. At Stags, we invest heavily in our students' well-being, as well as their academic education, and aim to allow them to flourish in the community that cares about both.
And here are listings of some musical events that may be of interest. And this first one is accompanied by a very cheerful picture of the Lee Singers with their conductor Victoria Longdon. The Lee Singers will pay tribute to the music of Notre Dame Cathedral at a concert in Harpenden this weekend. On April the 15th, the world watched in horror as Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris was devastated by fire. In the immediate aftermath, there was better news. Many of the treasures of the cathedral, including the grand organ, had survived. To commemorate these events, the Lee Singers will perform a programme of predominantly French music on Saturday, November the 16th at 7:30 p.m. at St. John's Church, Southdown. The choir will be accompanied by two organs, the St. John's Loft organ and a Hauptwerk digital organ, which through the wonders of technology and powerful speakers, samples the sound of a grand cathedral organ by Cavaillé Coll, the great 19th century organ builder who developed the organ of Notre Dame. This magnificent organ will be played by Jeremiah Stevenson and the St. John's organ by Simon Hogan. Tickets for Notre Dame, Rising in Song, cost £15 and £7 for the under-18s. They can be purchased in advance from Anne-Marie Kramer on 07939 366283.
And another musical opportunity. Carlos' masterpiece, Carmina Burana, will be performed by the St. Albans Bach Choir this weekend. The Bach Choir's next concert will take place on Saturday, November the 16th, in St. Albans Cathedral. The ever-popular work is a musical roller coaster, vividly reflecting the earthy medieval texts, which celebrate life and love, and wryly comment on the adverse turns of fortune's wheel. Music director Andrew Lucas said, "Carmina Burana is an exciting work that everyone recognises when they hear it, featuring very high in the classic FM charts and made extremely popularly known through its use in film, on TV and in advertisements. The music contrasts passages that are vigorous, rhythmic and upbeat with those that are serene, lyrical and beautiful." The choir is joined by renowned soloists, soprano Samantha Hay, tenor Robert Lewis and baritone Eddie Wade, the boys of St. Albans Cathedral Choir, and the brass and percussion of Sinfonia Verdi.
A regular performer at St. Peter's Church returns next week for the Wednesday lunchtime recital. Pianist and composer Elisa Fersova will perform a recital at St. Peter's on November the 20th, along with Moscow-born cellist Anatoly Lieberman. The programme will include Beethoven's Seven Variations on Bei Mähnerin, Welke Liebe fühlen from Mozart's Magic Flute, and Shostakovich's Sonata for Cello and Piano. Since winning the BBC Proms Young Composer competition back in 2001, Elisa Fersova has received two world premieres at the Proms, which were conducted by Andrew Litton, and a third by the National Youth Choir of Great Britain and Southbank Sinfonia. Anatoly Lieberman and Elisa Fersova formed a duo partnership at the music festival in Château de Canisy, which is in Normandy, in 2007. They gave their London debut recital in December 2009 and have covered a wide range of cello and piano repertoire since. Lunchtime recitals start at 1 p.m. with donations in aid of Rennie Grove Hospice Care.
Charity concert. A charity concert to help fund a premature incubator for sick babies in South Sudan will be held in Harpenden this week. From Mozart to Monty Python, An Enchanted Evening of Song will take you on a journey from 18th century opera to modern day musical theatre via music hall, operetta and GNS. A heady mix of classic beauty and comedy, there's something to suit all tastes at Lord's Hall in Southdown on Saturday, November the 16th at 7:30 p.m. Performed by the Felici Opera, the concert is organised by the Developing World Group, Our Lady of Lord Church. Proceeds from the night will go to the parish's Developing World Group, whose latest project was to pay around £3,800 for an incubator for premature and other sick babies in the St. Therese Hospital in Nzara, South Sudan. Tickets at £15 each are available from dennis29@virginmedia.com or via the Book Tickets tab on the Enchanted Evening page at www.felicioopera.com.
And here are the radio listings from Saturday the 16th of November to Friday the 22nd of November. For Saturday the 16th of November, Moira Stewart's Hall of Fame concert at Classic FM at 3pm gives the now Classic FM newsreader and presenter a chance to air her choices, which are played in full today. The list includes Caturian, Tchaikovsky, Handel, Saint-Saëns and Vaughan Williams. Opera on 3 on Radio 3 at 6:30pm is a performance of Richard Strauss's exotic adult fairy tale Die Frau ohne Schatten, recorded on the 10th of November, 100 years to the day after its premiere at the Vienna State Opera. This performance by the chorus and orchestra of the Vienna State Opera is conducted by Christian Thielemann. On Radio 4 Extra at 7pm, Hardware, Software, Anywhere is a new 3-hour thought-provoking technology special. Nick Baker drafts in guests such as Stephen Fry and Mary Beard to discuss the future of our changing language in an audio collection tracing the changes in technology. For Sunday, 17th of November, Lauren Reverne's guest on Desert Island Discs at 11:15 on Radio 4 is the actor Stephen Graham, whose acting credits include Line of Duty, Boardwalk Empire, Rocket Man and, just released, The Irishman. Also on Radio 4 at 4:30pm, the poet Julia Copus honours the works of Charlotte Mew, born in 1869. Although working alongside the Bloomsbury set with admirers such as Thomas Hardy, Siegfried Sassoon and Virginia Woolf, she was never really part of it, and her reputation did not last. However, this is rectified by Copus and Mew's fine works are renewed for this 150th anniversary. On Radio 2 at 9pm, singer-songwriter musician Barry Manilow continues his series of They Write the Songs. This programme highlights the massive career of Paul Simon, both as a solo artist and in his collaboration with Art Garfunkel.
A look now at programmes that run on each day through the week from Monday. On Radio 4 FM at 9:30am, George Eliot, A Life in Five Characters, is a new series to mark the 200th anniversary of the birth of George Eliot. Contemporary writers explore her life through five of her characters, one for each episode this week. At 10am on Radio 4 Extra, Strangers and Brothers is an adaptation of C.P. Snow's series of novels, The New Men, Homecomings, The Affair and Corridors of Power, with a cast including David Haig and Tom McInerney. At midday on Radio 3, the composer of the week is Mary Lou Williams, 1910 to 1981. She overcame an impoverished childhood, racial segregation and gender discrimination, not to mention domestic abuse, two divorces and a gambling addiction, to become one of America's jazz greats. She was a prolific composer and arranger, as well as a gifted pianist. At 4 minutes past noon and repeated at 10:45pm on Radio 4, Voltaire's satirical novel Candide is about good and evil and was published in 1759. It has been abridged by Robin Brooks and is read by Adrian Scarborough. The essay Legacies of 1619 on Radio 3 at 10:45pm is marking the 400th anniversary of the arrival of African slaves in America. In each episode this week, the programme presenter reflects on the lives of some of these amazing characters. At 11:30pm, in Stranger Than Sci-Fi on Radio 4, astrophysicist Jen Gupta and comedian Alice Fraser travel the parallel worlds of science and sci-fi. Starting with the latest books and films, they discover real-life science, that sounds too strange to be true.
Here are some picks for each day from Monday through to Friday. On Monday the 18th of November at 11 a.m. on Radio 4, The Untold is a new series of 13 episodes. Grace Dent returns with more stories of 21st century Britain, beginning with a medical student determined to do what she can to save the environment. At 8 p.m, also on Radio 4, is Designing a World for Everyone. Jeremy Myerson tells the story of industrial designer and gerontologist Patricia Moore, who in 1979 disguised herself as an 85-year-old to discover the realities of being old in America and Canada. This is Radio Times' pick for the week and is repeated on Wednesday at 11 a.m. On Tuesday the 19th of November, on Radio 4 at 9 a.m, there is a new series of four programmes of The Long View. In this first episode, Jonathan Friedland is joined by historian Evelyn Welch and guests to compare the bonfire of the vanities in 15th century Florence with Extinction Rebellion protests in today's London. In both cities, idealistic young activists took over the streets to persuade their fellow citizens to give up their consumption of sinful luxuries. The 2:15 p.m. drama on Radio 4 is The National. This new series of three episodes is airing over 3 days this week, ending on Thursday. With a superb cast headed by Robert Glenister as Sir Laurence Olivier, Sarah Woolley's drama tells the story of the fight to establish a successful national theatre. File on 4 at 8 p.m. on Radio 4 examines the shortages of prescribed drugs, which medics are saying is now worse than ever. Adrian Goldberg discovers the complex network behind the medication where prescribed and uncovers a long-running crisis at the very centre of UK healthcare. Following this at 8:40 p.m. is In Touch, a roundup of news, views and information for the blind or partially sighted, which is presented by Peter White. At 10 p.m. on Radio 3, the Free Thinking programme investigates the gentrification of Margate. When the Turner Art Gallery opened in 2011, many hoped that the deprived seaside town would benefit. As this year's Turner Prize comes to Margate, Philip Dodd looks at whether the arts are a successful driver of regeneration.
For Wednesday, 20th November, the Scottish comedian and writer Susan Kalman begins a new series of four programmes exploring the things in life that brings her happiness. Susan Kalman Makes Me Happy is on Radio 4 at 6:30 p.m. Radio 3 In Concert at 7:30 p.m. is live from the Lighthouse in Poole. David Hill marks his 10th anniversary as associate guest conductor of the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra with a pairing of Elgar's only song cycle, Sea Pictures, and Brahms' A German Requiem. For Thursday the 21st of November, on Radio 4 at 11:30 a.m, Write Brummie is a documentary capturing people in the act of writing throughout the city of Birmingham over a 24-hour period. Radio 3 In Concert at 7:30 p.m. is live from Bridgewater Hall in Manchester, with the BBC Philharmonic Orchestra. The music's inspired by the Arctic and involves the theremin, a hands-free electronic instrument created in the 1920s by a Soviet inventor who gave it its name. For Friday the 22nd of November, Radio 3's In Concert at 7:30 p.m. was recorded earlier in the week from St George's Hall Concert Room in Liverpool, and a piano recital also offers the chance to hear one of the most challenging works in the repertoire, Liszt's Sonata in B Minor, played by Mariam Batsashvili, a BBC New Generation artist. At 8 p.m. on Radio 2, Friday night is Music Night. Singer and broadcaster Beverly Knight performs live with the BBC Concert Orchestra.
Deborah Heath is with me again to talk about a book, an audiobook, Midwich Cuckoos by John Wyndham. Now, John Wyndham was writing in the 1950s, thereabouts.
He started before that. He was brought up in quite a privileged family and wrote because he didn't have to earn an income. Eventually he did. So I think he started just before the war, and he did a few books with his real surname, which wasn't Wyndham. It was something else. Wyndham was one of his middle names. And he messed around with all five or six of his names. And then he had a very interesting Second World War, which I'm sure has affected his writing. He was involved in cracking ciphers and was also, strangely, in the Home Guard. He was a fire watcher, and eventually he did go into the forces. When the war finished, his brother had started to be quite a prolific writer, and I suppose he felt a bit jealous, so he thought he would change his style. So the books we associate with him, certainly under this name, tend to be science fiction.
The title, The Midwich Cuckoos, has got two key words to it. Midwich, which is the name of the place,
yes,
which is a village, and that's where the story starts, in and around that village, and it's all about that, what becomes the Midwich Day Out,
yes,
a day that disappears from the calendar. And the cuckoos is because it takes the idea of what the cuckoo actually does, which is get into somebody else's nest and lay its egg, and that egg has a dramatic effect on the rest of the eggs in that nest.
Yes, so it takes over. It hatches before the mother bird's real eggs, and it demands much more of her attention and often pushes the other eggs and birds out of the nest. That's very relevant to the story.
Now, we're sort of teasing, we're playing around with this, but before we get into the plot itself, there's a lot of narration in this, isn't there? There's a lot of talk by the author, if you like, or by his principal character, his narrator.
It's interesting, and I think we should touch on that a bit later when we're sort of summarising the book. But let's talk about the role of the narrator. It's quite an interesting one because the narrator doesn't really take part in the story. He lives in Midwich, but has taken a day off. So he comes back and says at the beginning that he's collected people's memories. They might not be quite in the right order, but he is basically a reporter. He reports back to us. And although he is present during some of the strange things that go on, he is very much an outsider.
The story really begins with him and his wife. They were out for the day. They came back to their village, Midwich, but couldn't get through.
What happened was that everyone was carrying on their normal business, and then suddenly everything stopped.
From 10:17 that night, information about Midwich becomes episodic. Its telephones remained dead. The bus that should have passed through it failed to reach Stouch, and a truck that went to look for the bus did not return. A notification from the RAF was received in train of some unidentified flying object. Not, repeat not, a service machine, detected by radar in the Midwich area, possibly making a forced landing. Someone in Opley reported a house on fire in Midwich, with apparently nothing being done about it. The train fire appliance turned out and thereafter failed to make any reports. The train police dispatched a car to find out what had happened to the fire engine, and that too vanished into silence. Opley reported a second fire, and still seemingly nothing being done. Constable Gobby in Stouch was rung up and sent off on his bicycle to Midwich, and no more was heard of him, either.
People were on the telephone, and suddenly everything went dead. People were on a bus, and the driver stopped driving, and everyone froze.
There were people who died as a result of this, what we call the day out, and we'll come to explain it more as we go through, a day when something happened. And therefore, the police first, I guess, and then the army.
Yeah, so it all becomes a little bit top secret, doesn't it? And I must say, I lost track of which government agencies were involved. But nevertheless, they had some very clever scientists and military officials in to come and see what had happened. And what they worked out was that it was not only sort of the ground level of Midwich that had been affected, but also the height. So they sent an aeroplane up to do investigations, and it didn't end very well for the people in that aeroplane. So think of it in effect like a sort of a dome where inside everything stopped. So they did a few experiments, including, I felt very sorry for the canary in a cage, but they found a canary.
He lowered his pole from the vertical, and with the cage still dangling at its end, thrust it forward tentatively. The bird fell off its perch and lay on the sanded floor of the cage. The corporal withdrew the cage. The bird gave a slightly indignant tweet and hopped back on its perch. One watching private stepped forward with his bucket and daubed a little whitewash on the grass. The other made a mark on his map. The party then moved along a dozen yards or so and repeated the performance.
They couldn't see it, they couldn't smell it, they couldn't feel it.
Yes.
But there was this dome of something. And in fact, the narrator and his wife both tried to avoid the police blockage and the army blockage by going across the fields, and they consecutively collapse into sleep. When they're brought back out, memorably by a pole with a boat hook on the end, as it were, by somebody, pulls them back up, they wake up again. So it's not fatal. Whatever this is not fatal.
But people are very confused about it. Eventually, the effects wear off, and it seems that everything returns to normal in Midwich. It's just referred to colloquially as the day out, and everybody carries on with their business as if nothing had happened. And I think the government have done quite a good job of covering it up and keeping it hush-hush.
Because there is a mysterious ministry building inside that village.
Yes,
I think it was the Grange.
The Grange,
taken over
right.
by a ministry for research. We never really get
no,
to the bottom
we
of
don't,
this.
We don't
know what's going on there. Anyway, so the Grange is there, something's going on, but as you say, the police, the authorities keep it very quiet. You don't get a lot of media reporting on it. It's
no.
really quite covered up. And then something happens a bit later.
After a few weeks, maybe a couple of months, the women of Midwich, well, a lot of the women, start to notice some changes, namely that they appear to be pregnant. The strange thing about this is that some of them have had no means of getting pregnant, and it's all a little bit of a surprise.
Farrellin ate some cornflakes, drank some coffee, and accepted a fried egg and bacon. After two nibbles, she pushed the plate away decisively enough to arouse Angela from her reflections. "What's the matter?" Angela inquired from her end of the table. "Isn't it fresh?" "Oh, there's nothing wrong with it," Farrellin told her. "I just don't happen to feel eggy this morning, that's all." Angela seemed uninterested. When one had half hoped, she would ask why. An inside voice seemed to prompt Farrellin. Why not now? After all, it can't really make much difference when, can it? So she took a breath. By way of introducing the matter gently, she said, As a matter of fact, Angela, I was sick this morning. Oh? Indeed, said her stepmother, and paused while she helped herself to butter. In the act of raising her marmaladed toast, she added, So was I. Horrid, isn't it?
It's all the women who are of childbearing age, isn't
exactly.
it? So if they were older than that, they weren't affected. If they were younger than that, they weren't affected. It's all the women who were in a position where, because of their age and their health and whatever else, were able to become pregnant.
Yes. So we have some teenagers and we have some older maiden ladies. Oh, very shocking indeed for those maiden ladies. And they go and see the vicar about it. And eventually all the bigwigs of the town, including the vicar, the doctor and Zellaby himself, he's an academic, moral philosophy or something. I'm not quite sure.
And it's his daughter and his
wife,
second or third
second,
wife. Angela is the second or third wife, I can't remember which, but his daughter, Farrellin, that we were talking earlier.
Yes.
So this is the husband. He's older than his wife.
Yes.
He's, as you say, an academic. He gets very interested in the detail of this and has a lot to say about various things.
Mm.
And he lives in the other big house in the village, I think that's...
That's right. So the bigwigs get together and Angela leads a talk for all the women who are affected, and she's basically saying, you know, we've got to get through it together. We don't know what's going on. It's all a bit strange, but we need to keep it quiet, keep our heads down, and not tell anyone outside of Midwich. And so they continue in their pregnancies. They're obviously very worried, but they do some form of scan. I think they're talking about x-rays. It seems very dangerous to give x-rays to pregnant women now, doesn't it? But they can tell that the babies are developing normally and seem to be large and healthy. And eventually these babies are born and seem to be absolutely perfect, apart from a slightly strange thing that they all have golden eyes.
They're all growing at the same age. I mean, they've all started at the same time, on
yes.
the same day, the Midwich day out. I think, as far as I remember, not all of them survive the pregnancy.
Yes.
There are a few fatalities.
A bit later, when they were a couple of months old, there was some influenza in the village and some of them died, including Farrellin's child. But the interesting thing is that as these children develop, they develop much more quickly than one would expect. So we're left with infants, really, who have the mental processes of a 4 or 5 year old. Zellaby is very quick to notice this and conducts a few experiments. So Zellaby gathers some important people, including the narrator and his wife, and shows them something very interesting. One by one, he approaches some of the girls and boys separately. So starting with a boy, he teaches it a trick, how to get a barley sugar out of a box, quite an intricate box. Then he goes to the next boy. But this boy doesn't have to learn how to do it like the first boy. He just instinctively does it, even though he's only about 1 or 2 years old. Then he goes to a girl. The first girl has to learn how to perform the trick as well. The second girl instinctively knows how to do it.
Mr. Zellaby, are you claiming that if I were to tell anything to any one of the boys, all the rest would know it?
Certainly. Provided, of course, that it was something simple enough for them to understand at this stage.
Janet looked highly sceptical.
Selleby sighed. "The old trouble," he said. "Lynch Darwin, and you show the impossibility of evolution. But, as I said, you've only to apply your own tests."
And what he concludes is that there is a collective individualism. Specifically, there is one male identity and one female identity, which is really very curious.
"We don't have here one single group en rapport. We have two separate groups of rapport, apparently without cross-connections. Now, if that is so, and we have seen that it is, a question that immediately presents itself is this. To what extent is any of these children an individual? Each is physically an individual, as we can see, but is he so in other ways? If he is sharing consciousness with the rest of the group instead of having to communicate with others with difficulty, as we do, can he be said to have a mind of his own, a separate personality, as we understand it? I don't see that he can."
And as you say, they are older than their years all the way through. They appear to be growing at a faster rate, both physically and intellectually?
Exactly, yes. Yeah. So they're very large, they're very strong. And eventually, this creeps everyone out so much that all the children are encouraged, or actually I think they choose, to go and live at the Grange. It's interesting to note that the children don't want to leave Midwich. So sometimes the parents will try to take them out in the car. But there's just some sort of strange force that always brings them back again. So they have to live in the village. And eventually, Angela escapes, leaving her child behind. So the children are eventually living at the Grange together.
Now, there's a limit to how far we can go. And the tricky thing about this is that almost anything we say beyond this point is going to give the plot away.
Yes.
Because these kids have got a certain sort of characteristics and certain sort of natures which become more and more relevant to the story.
Yes.
And they dictate what happens.
Yes. So we want to leave it at a place where things are intriguing. It is very intriguing. And you want to read on. So I think this is the place to stop discussing the plot.
I mean, it does roll along. I felt at first when I was reading it thinking, this feels like a 1950s movie, which is an odd thing to think. It has that sort of pedanticism of the narration falling on and forward and forward and forward. And you think, oh, come on, start jumping corners, because, you know, nowadays we don't have that level of continuous narration.
No, that's right. And it was referred to by someone as a cosy catastrophe. That's absolutely what it is. It is cosy. It does feel 1950s, but it's certainly a catastrophe. There are quite a few deaths in this book. It's quite a horrible book. And yet you feel quite comforted by it at the same time.
And in fact, I quite enjoyed it because it had that, there was a coziness about it. I think there's various levels under this. I think that some of the other writers later have brought this out. So there's a sort of moral issues being raised here. There's an illustration I'd love to give about this, but I can't because that would give away half the plot. But there are things you think, okay, then this author is actually trying to say more than just tell a story. I enjoyed it as a storytelling.
Yeah.
I got a little bit irritated by it at times.
Yes.
Because it's a bit of, I'd like to explain this to you again slowly. Is that what I mean by narration?
Yeah, he just goes off on a tangent, doesn't he?
"It is because nature is ruthless, hideous and cruel beyond belief, that it was necessary to invent civilization. One thinks of wild animals as savage, but the fiercest of them begins to look almost domesticated when one considers the viciousness required of a survivor in the sea. As for the insects, their lives are sustained only by intricate process of fantastic horror. There is no conception more fallacious than the sense of cosiness implied by Mother Nature. Each species must strive to survive, and that it will do, by every means in its power, however foul. Unless the instinct to survive is weakened by conflict with another instinct." Angela seized the pause to put in, with a touch of impatience, "I've no doubt you're gradually working round to something, Gordon." Yes, Zellaby owned. "I'm working round again to cuckoos. Cuckoos are very determined survivors, so determined that there is really only one thing to be done with them, once one's nest is infested. I am, as you know, a humane man. I think I may even say a kindly man by disposition."
"You may, Gordon."
"As a further disadvantage, I am a civilized man. For these reasons, I shall not be able to bring myself to approve of what ought to be done, nor even when we perceive its advisability with the rest of us. So like the poor hen thrush, we shall feed and nurture the monster and betray our own species."
This is typical, really, of Zellerby. He goes off on one. He's an academic. He is possibly John Wyndham's mouthpiece.
Although Wyndham uses somebody else as his narrator,
yeah.
He's actually got two narrators in
there.
He has, sense,
he? Yeah. He's exploring ideas. He's playing devil's advocate. And in fact, the narrator's wife, Janet, approaches things from another point of view altogether. So she really challenges Zellerby. So they're all very scientific in their way. What I've concluded, having read the book now twice and watched the film, is this is a cracking story, but it's not a great book. It starts off, probably the first half is really good. It rolls along. It's very engaging. But like you, I got frustrated at some of the asides. But I do think it's worth reading because the story is so good and because it does give a lot of opportunity for discussion with other people who've read it. So when I finished it, I wanted you to read it. I wanted my husband to read it. I just wanted to discuss it with someone. It's a very, very good story with some interesting things to say.
And it certainly develops the characters. You know who these people, you can visualise these people. That's why I said
absolutely.
It felt like a 1950s film, because I
yes.
could see them
yes, me too.
Through the text, which is quite clever to do, I think, for a writer, because you're not just stuck in the words, where you can actually visualise it very easily.
So you read it in book form?
I read it in book form.
Okay, so of course I had to listen to it because of my eyesight issues, and it's read by Nathaniel Parker. It's absolutely brilliant. I have some issues with audiobooks because people like me are forced to listen to them because we can't read ourselves. But often what you're getting is the interpretation of the narrator. So you can never come to it completely cold, really. You've always got someone else's ideas there. At times, that is very frustrating. Nathaniel Parker here reads in such an animated fashion, and yet you kind of don't notice him reading it. And that's absolutely how it should be. He gets into each character, he paints a picture, and I think this is a really good example of a very talented audiobook narrator. So I enjoyed something that I wasn't expecting to enjoy.
Good. Well, we're talking about the book, The Midwich Cuckoos, and about the cuckoos themselves, these kids who are born with these golden eyes and the blonde hair and powers that we learn more and more about as we go on. It's narrated, as you said, by Nathaniel Parker. It lasts for approximately 6.5 hours, so it's not a huge listen, which is good. Thank you very much, Debbie, for talking about that
You're
book.
Welcome.
And our thanks go, as ever, to Calibre Audio for providing us with a CD from which we could take those extracts.
Hello, this is Lucy, and this is a very interesting article from Hertfordshire Life magazine about the Knights Templar and their connections with Hertfordshire. 9 centuries after the Knights Templar was founded, they still fire the imagination. In Herts, a key temple, land, and the creation of a new town are all part of the story and legend. It's 900 years since the order was founded in Jerusalem, but the Knights Templar has lost none of its power to captivate and intrigue us. Speculation and conspiracy about its activities at home and abroad continues to inspire books, films, and last year a major television drama, Nightfall, with fans eagerly awaiting season 2. But did you know there are strong connections between Hertfordshire and this most famous yet mysterious of religious orders? Formed in around 1119, historians can't quite agree the date, after the first crusade to protect Christian pilgrims travelling to the Holy Land, the Templars, or the Poor Fellow Soldiers of Christ and of the Temple of Solomon, as they are properly called, are best known as an elite fighting force. But their remit over time went much wider than crusading. While knights battled to keep Jerusalem in Christian hands, the growing band of the Templars' non-fighting representatives wielded power of another kind, acting as bankers and advisers to royalty and the ruling classes of Europe, controlling a sizeable empire which stretched across the continent. It was with a view to recruiting new crusaders that the Order's Grand Master ventured to England in 1128. The country was to become an important territory for the Templars. The Middle Eastern Crusades drained money and manpower with astonishing speed, and England provided willing recruits for the cause and generated much-needed funds to finance it. Income came primarily from land holdings. Sizable plots were gifted to the Templars by noblemen and wealthy landowners who believed that assisting the order was their Christian duty, and such a donation would ensure their sins were absolved in the afterlife. Extensive land holdings, including many sites in Hertfordshire, allowed the Templars to accrue rents and produce commodities for trade, and also assisted with its banking operations. The order acted as guardians of money and valuables for pilgrims and crusaders travelling to the Middle East, giving them a letter of credit which could be exchanged for funds in other Templar territories. Its European network of secure estates also made them ideally placed to assist with the transfer of funds between countries. Hertfordshire had a stake in these activities, not least because of its proximity to the capital and its good infrastructure network. So important was the county, in fact, the Templars chose to place a preceptory here, second only to that of its English headquarters, Temple Church, today in the City of London. Temple Dinsley was in Preston, near Hitchin, on land where Princess Helena College now stands. The monastery cum fortified manor house hosted the ceremonies at which the majority of Englishmen joining the order were officially received as knights. It was also at Temple Dinsley that the Templars held many of their national chapter meetings, through which the order's activities across England were managed. On a day-to-day basis, the preceptory was probably home to members of the order who managed Templar land in the area and ensured the profits were safely transferred abroad. They would have acted much as any conventional lord of the manor, collecting rents from tenants who farmed the land which lay beyond the preceptory's walls, employing labourers and taking advantage of the fishing and hunting privileges the order had been granted. Since these privileges were extensive and the Templars enjoyed exemption from many taxes, it's likely there was friction between the order and the local community. Evidence suggests the Templars were fairer landlords than some, however. Crusader and Hitchin Lord of the Manor, Bernard de Balliol, gave land in the area to the Templars. He probably worshipped at Temple Dinsley and was eventually buried there. A worn and damaged stone effigy of a knight in armour with sword lying at rest under one of the windows of St Mary's Church in Hitchin is thought to be him, taken from his tomb. It's one of the very few objects that link to the old preceptory. Nothing of the building itself remains. A more lasting testament to the Templars' time in the county is Baldock. The creation of a new town here by the Templars was a money-making venture, and they chose their location well. By 1185, Baldock was a thriving market town and one of the order's most profitable sites in England, thanks to its situation on both the main road north from London and the Icknield Way. The Templars encouraged merchants to relocate to the town with exemptions from market tolls and divided up the land around it into small plots for lease by tenant farmers, ensuring a steady stream of rental income. The order's handiwork is still evident in the town's layout, which retains a very wide high street, set aside for a marketplace. At the end of the high street, the parish church of St Mary's has a relic of the Templar era too. Although the church, built on the site by the order, was substantially redeveloped in the 14th and 15th centuries, part of the original chancel remains. The name of the town is also a link to the Templars' crusades. It is thought to derive from the old French word baldac, Baghdad. While Baldock and Preston are indisputably connected with the Templars, the county also has its share of the myth and speculation which so often surrounds the order. Under the streets of Royston is a man-made cavern, its walls covered with carvings. That it was once used by the Templars as a secret hideout remains a popular theory, particularly since some of the carvings appear to depict saints known to have been revered by the order. But as cave manager James Robinson says, any link with the Templars is purely in the realms of speculation. It's been the subject of conjecture since it was discovered in 1742 by workmen. Opinion has now shifted against any link with the Templars. Experts believe the carvings were created long after the order was disbanded. But where concrete evidence is lacking, there will always be room for speculation. And given the Templars' ultimate fate, it's tempting to believe they went underground in the face of persecution. It was primarily a malign propaganda campaign that led to the order's spectacular fall from grace in 1307, what historian Dan Jones has called medieval fake news. The Templars were accused of some of the blackest offences of their time, including corruption, blasphemy, and sexual crimes. This campaign would not have been so successful, however, if there had not been by this time growing dissatisfaction at its failure to keep the Crusader states in Christian hands. Deeply in debt to the Templars, King Philip IV of France ordered arrests, torture, and burning at the stake. In 1308, Edward II of England also ordered the arrest of Templars. Six were seized that year at Temple Dinsley. The preceptory itself was the subject of a subsequent inquiry, as it was rumoured to be the hiding place of much of the Templars' vast wealth. In fact, what wealth the Templars had in England was chiefly in the form of land and property, most of which was given away to a rival organisation, the Hospitallers, when the order was formally dissolved by Pope Clement V in 1312. Despite extensive searches, no treasure was found at Preston, nor has it been since. Although the rumour persists to this day, even the girls of Princess Helena College have been known to take a dip in the school pond looking for the fabled treasure. The Templars might be long gone from the county, but they've certainly never been forgotten. There are some great pictures accompanying this article. There's one of a 13th century miniature in some very jewel-like colours, that very jewel-like blue colour and reds and yellows. And it shows some weaponry used by the Knights Templar, catapults, battle axes and maces, and a longbow and broadsword as well. And it's from the Crusader Bible, created around 1240. And there's also rather an intriguing and disturbing illustration as well of two Knights Templar being burnt at the stake on the Ile de Cité in Paris in March 1314, which is taken from the Grande Chronique de France.
We're coming to the end of this week's programme. Thanks as ever to all our contributors, including our readers, Margaret, Elizabeth, Dominic and Sarah, and Lucy. And as ever, thank you for listening. Steve will be here next week with the next edition of the News Extra programme, but that's all from me, Bill Redway, in November 2019. We close with Bright Nights by Searson. I do hope you enjoy it. Goodbye.
Thank you.